Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program, South Africa's trade watchdog is swamped. ITAC faces an unprecedented caseload. Chinese car brands could lose their edge as government eyes tougher import tariffs. Trade wars are tearing into South Africa's workforce and women are bearing the brunt. And is a fast, stable internet platform a basic human right or still a luxury in this country? It's Tuesday, the 19th of August. South Africa's trade regulator, the International Trade Administration Commission of South Africa, we know it better as ITAC, is facing a big caseload as global trade tensions rise. I guess that's fairly predictable. Despite unilateral US tariffs and a flood of cheap imports, particularly from China, ITAC says, though, it's not going to engage in what it terms tit-for-tat retaliation. Instead, it insists that any protective tariffs will only be used to safeguard local industries. The chief commissioner is joins me on the program now. Commissioner, you've described the current caseload as unprecedented. How much more work is the commission handling compared to the past couple of years?
Thank you so much, Jeremy, for the opportunity. And I think the remarks about the caseload were quite particular to what are remedial measures. And for the benefit of your listeners, there's a distinction between ordinary customs duty amendments on the tariff schedule and trade remedy investigations responding to dumping or the landing of subsidized imports or even a surge in imports that requires safeguard measures. And it is in that latter arena that we've seen unprecedented caseloads. In any one year, historically, Jeremy, you would have had in the post-2007-8 period anywhere between about kind of 5 to 7 investigations in the pipeline at different stages, involving product markets in the tariff schedule, where applicants, which are South African industrial firms, are alleging that there's been dumping or there's been a need for safeguard in response to a flood of import. We've seen that number moving comfortably into the double-digit terrain in terms of the investigations in our merit assessments, right through to those we've initiated, and even the spread and diversity of the products in question. In the last 2 years or so, emerging, of course, from, as I argue, chronic overcapacity and overproduction in certain product markets.
So that's the broad overview. I want to focus on tariffs, if I can. The US, as we know, has slapped tariffs on key exports. Why has ITAC chosen restraint rather than retaliation?
Well, so I think there are probably two reasons, Jeremy. I think the first is that we do not make tariff decisions in South Africa by executive order or fiat, as is the case we saw in the United States and even in some other countries that have done away with their trade authorities and given that decision to members of the executive. India is one example of that as well. So we don't have that system in South Africa. We have a system where a investigative and deliberative body makes a recommendation to a member of the executive who then ultimately makes the decision. And so the member of the executive is also bound to the extent that they can make a decision on a tariff by an underlying recommendation, in this instance, from the commission. Mm. And so as long as we've got that system, it binds us towards making decisions on the balance of evidence rather than episodic or conjunctural changes where we would have to reactively retaliate. So that's the first reason. The second reason, I think, is a broader geopolitical reason. We're a small open market economy in a world where there's a law of the jungle and decisions are made by might whether that is consumptive or industrial might, we can't win in that type of thing. And that's why we have an interest in a predictable rules-based multilateral order. That is our foreign policy position. And effectively, that informs why it might not be in our national interest to retaliate. Does that mean we can't respond? Of course, the response, as you would have heard from Minister Tau and Minister Lamola, is about how do we support firms to diversify, not only where it is they sell to, but also the extent to which they can use existing raw material processes, capabilities, skills, and know-how to be able to widen what it is that they produce and the markets that they can sell into.
You talk about South Africa being a rules-based country. I absolutely accept that. But in many respects, Washington has torn that rule book up. And critics are saying that failing to respond with perhaps greater force, or at least equal force, could maybe embolden trade partners. Is South Africa not in danger of sending a signal of weakness?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that is probably in the realm of innuendo, and other psychologists might tell you about signals of weakness and how those are dealt with. What I can speak to, Jeremy, is that to the extent that our trade policy requires we make decisions on the balance of evidence, we will continue to do so. But the second one is this idea that retaliation with the scale of market we have might have other unintended consequences that might potentially be much more counterproductive to our industrial policy ambitions. That's the first one. But the second and much more important one is, you're correct, the multilateral system and trading, global trading order, has been undone. And you're correct that sometimes we are much more pious than the Pope when it comes to the multilateral order. But we do recognize that in the debris of this broken system, there will have to be, among a group or a constellation of countries, the creation of some rules-based order that will create some predictability. And this, you would know, Jeremy, is not the first time this has happened in history. Look at how the imperial systems of preference broke up at the height or near the end of the British Empire, just prior to the Great Depression. And following that depression, right through into the Second World War, you had a breakdown of a British overseen global multilateral order that was replaced by the one that we are seeing being undone at the moment.
I understand that, but do we have the luxury of time while that new order starts to emerge? Try telling that to a citrus farmer or to a wine merchant.
No, correct. And I think you're right that our tools are too sticky. And that's why we have to amend the tools that enable us to respond. And you would have, I think, seen that in some of the sectors, we've moved away from this kind of product by product to try and move towards a much more systemic response. Take the steel sector. We looked at a submission, which we are going to be issuing a gazette for this week, which is starting to say, well, this thing of taking a piecemeal approach requires a systemic response that makes use of the policy space we have under the prevailing WTO system. If that is not adequate, then of course, certain legislative changes have to be made. So a lot of this doesn't only rest with an administrative or investigative body like ITAC, but I think is a much broader legislative question. If the WTO system, which we have ratified as a country, is undone, what is the legislative agenda for us to put something else in its place? And I think that question is probably much more above my pay grade.
So just a quick question and a quick answer in closing.
Yes.
And it's, again, perhaps more philosophical. Given this new hostile trade climate, is there at some point the need for us to rethink our long-standing commitment to free trade principles, given that rule book has now changed?
No, I agree. And I mean, this is why I was saying we've been more pious than the Pope when this system has been undone. We do need to have a strategic engagement with it, but also in some instances a strategic delinking from it. And if that means putting in place rapid response mechanisms to use the tools you have, I mean, let me give you an example. A safeguard investigation or a dumping investigation takes 18 months in some cases. Yeah, sometimes firms don't have 18 months. So what mechanisms can you put in place? And we've seen in the United Kingdom and the EU, they've changed their safeguard regulations to bring in steel from places like Turkey rapidly in response to things that are happening in some of these product markets. And I think that requires many of our lawmakers sitting in Parliament and even the policymakers and the executive to probably look at that and make the necessary changes. And to the extent that we assist them with that and thinking through that, we'll continue to do so.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Ayabonga Qawe, who is the Chief Commissioner at the International Trade Administration Commission of South Africa. I appreciate your time.
Smart minds, big moves, one summit. Join the country's leading thinkers, doers, and decision makers at the MoneyWeb Money Summit. It's happening on the 9th of September at the Sandton Convention Center. It's one full day of powerful insights, real opportunities, and bold conversations shaping South Africa's economic future. And the best part? Your ticket is free. Just use the code MoneyWebGuest when you register. Visit moneysummit.co.za now. MoneyWeb Money Summit, where smart money moves.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you'll be well aware that South Africa's automotive sector is under increasing strain. Cheaper Chinese imports have been arriving in the market. Local manufacturers are battling plant closure, job loss, and also missed production targets. Government is now considering higher tariffs to protect domestic jobs and to boost local content. But that could spell trouble for Chinese brands whose competitive edge lies in the price. Well, I'm going to discuss this now with Beth Diltree, who's head of policy and regulatory affairs at the National Association of Automotive Component and Allied Manufacturers. We know it better as NACAM. Beth, a very warm welcome. So let's start there. The influx of low-cost Chinese cars, is it an opportunity for consumers or an existential threat to the local industry, or maybe both?
Yeah, look, I think absolutely consumers are enjoying the lower prices, but from an industry perspective, I think it was loud and clear at the NACAM show last week that it is an existential threat for the industry. If we look at, we've had relatively stagnant vehicle sales, although this year it is starting to pick up. We were aiming at this point, based on the master plan, to have about 55% of those sales being locally produced vehicles, and instead we're sitting with only 37% being locally. So there's been a massive rise of these brands, and ultimately what does it mean? There's less demand for locally produced vehicles. A lot of the business model for these local manufacturers is based on the premise of a domestic market that is growing. Without that, we're seeing production shortfalls. This is impacting the entire supply chain, and ultimately the end result is the plant closures, job losses that you mentioned.
Beth, I always get nervous when I hear the word master plan. Why are we still stuck below 40%?
Yeah, so that 40% you refer to is local content, and you're absolutely right. We have not moved really at all in the past two decades. Multiple reasons for it. The one is very obviously we haven't grown production sufficiently so. Localization business cases and anything in the automotive sector depends on economies of scale, and our production volumes have simply not grown substantially enough to unlock some level of localization. But equally, I think the policy program itself is currently the mechanics are not working as I think was originally premised or thought to. And what we're seeing is an over-support of probably assembly as opposed to supporting production and the value addition that comes from the component sector. So as NACAM, we're coming up to an APDP2 review, and this is our kind of big ticket item, is how do we fix the mechanics of APDP2 so that we've got a much stronger force behind pushing that localization level above 40. I mean, maybe just for the listeners, what I always find interesting is there is a significant range between our OEMs that are in the country, their local content levels, which naturally suggests that there is an opportunity to close that gap. How do we get those bottom end OEMs that aren't at the levels of some of the others, how do we get them to increase their local content? And that's a key focus for us, particularly this year.
While you're putting the finishing touches on that, the minister, of course, hinting at tariff hikes. That would be hugely significant for the auto industry if that were to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think it's always a bit of a political hot potato the second anyone talks about tariff hikes. But if you look at our tariff system or how APDP2 works, it works on a rebate premise. And so effectively, manufacturers are able to rebate their import duties. And these can also be sold to independent importers, allowing them to rebate the duties equally so. And so what you're seeing is whilst we read, you know, a 25% import tariff currently on vehicles and 20% on components, in actual fact, your actual or effective duty rate is much lower than that based on this rebate structure. So in actual effect, we don't have significant protection on the South African market when you start to look at the data. And I think if you look at many countries around the world, if we think of, say, Thailand as who we often compare ourselves to, if we see the rapid rise of India and equally China quite a few years ago, all of their industries were kind of catalyzed around a high level of market protection. So it's certainly something that in this APDP2 review needs to be considered as how do we support the market in that sense.
But fundamentally, it's a debate between balancing affordability and protecting jobs, isn't it?
Absolutely so. And so you have to get that balance right. You know, on one hand, we certainly don't want to lose an automotive industry that would have a catastrophic effect on South Africa's manufacturing kind of economy, but a wider economy with that. But equally, you certainly don't want to have vehicles becoming entirely unaffordable for the South African consumer. So there has to be a middle ground that is found that supports the industry, supports growth, which will be good for South Africa as a whole, but as I said, still enables consumers to purchase vehicles.
But there's a real danger, isn't there, of South Africa losing more component manufacturers if the status quo remains? We saw, for instance, a Goodyear's exit.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's the interesting thing, is as much as we focus on the influx of cheaper, often Chinese brands from a vehicle perspective, it's happening in the component side of things too, particularly in your replacement market. You referred to Goodyear. I mean, if we look at the stats from the tire industry, 2020, we were 56% of the market share. We now sit down at 46%. We're naturally a low margin but high scale industry. And so any loss in demand for domestically produced, be it vehicles or components, has catastrophic effects. We're seeing the closures. Goodyear's the best example of it at the moment, but in the worst possible sense. And that's what we're trying to avoid. And that's what we need to kind of all coalesce behind, is how do we avoid this downward spiral of an industry?
Has the war not already been lost? Imports make up over 60% of vehicle sales. We are already beyond, surely, a tipping point for local manufacturers.
No, I don't think so. And I think that's why we still, as an industry, are as doom and gloom as it can sometimes sound, we're still optimistic that with the right couple of tweaks to the policy program and maybe some wider supporting infrastructure, we can turn things around. You know, the reality is, if we compare ourselves to China's industry is supported by a huge domestic market. Realistically, we can't be that, and we won't be that. We don't have that many people to buy cars. But there is still a role for South Africa to play in the value chain. We do have really world-class manufacturers on our shores. We have really good skills on our shores. We have a lot that puts us in a good position. It's about how do we get that in the right kind of environment to enable that growth. So no, I don't think it's too late. It certainly is critical that we do and we act quickly. I don't think we'll have the opportunity in, say, 5 years' time. But if we act swiftly now, there is still a role and an important role for South Africa to play in the automotive value chain.
And what is China currently doing at the moment? I understand it's cracking down on the price wars that fueled its global expansion in the first place. Surely that would play out positively in our market.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why I say not all is lost. I think there's a lot of change we are still likely to see coming out of China. I know when you speak to some of the Chinese brands, there's a recognition that there's a very stiff price war happening in China on vehicle pricing. And a lot of these prices seem well below what logic would dictate they should be at. And equally, there's been such a prolific rise of Chinese brands. There's a recognition that not all of them are going to survive. And so what you'll likely see is some of the Chinese brands slowly exiting the market over the next few years. And then suddenly, as a consumer in South Africa, you may be left with a vehicle which doesn't have the supporting infrastructure to support. So there's still a lot of changes happening in China. There's equally a lot of changes happening, you know, all around the world. You can see America is trying to grapple with the situation at the moment, as is Europe. So the whole auto industry is kind of being reordered or restructured as we sit and watch at the moment. And so I guess there's still a lot to play for in that reordering.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Beth Diltry, Head of Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the National Association of Automotive Component and Allied Manufacturers. Beth, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, global tariff war is battering and will continue to batter South Africa's economy, or Africa's economies. And female workers are taking the hardest hit. US duties of up to 50% on imports from over 90 countries are eroding hard-won trade gains under AGOA, threatening jobs, deepening inequality, and also pushing more work into insecure, low-paid arrangements. This is a real worry. Economist Dr. Ntabiseng Moleko, development economist at the University of Stellenbosch's Business School, is warning that without urgent policy shift, millions of people, particularly women, could face a future of diminished economic security. So, Dr. Moleko, welcome to you. South Africa, in particular, facing 30% tariffs as far as the United States is concerned. What is the immediate jobs impact, do you think, and in which sectors will women feel it first?
I think the reality is that our hardest hit sectors will be export-oriented industries, obviously, and small-scale farmers. And I think in particular, your manufacturing. The manufacturing sectors rely on export-driven sales. because we are buying power from countries in Europe, in the US or the global north, and also in the global south. But I think the tariff hikes specifically will hit industries like in the Western Cape, your wine farms. Who are the people within those sectors that will be impacted? It's not just the owners of businesses who will suffer in terms of being more competitive with their counterparts, but it's also those who are inputs, the laborers, the employees. And we know that in farming, citrus farming in the Western Cape, we know that with apple farming in the Western Cape, and even with wine farming in South Africa in general, with these sectors, they're heavily dependent on informal work of women. Women make a large portion of those women who work in those sectors. I think the second aspect that you have to look at is the labor-intensive industries. Women dominate sectors like textiles, right? Agricultural processing. And these, again, will be hit hard by the higher tariffs, and they will have significant impact on the extent to which we export if we don't diversify where we're exporting to, and particularly find other markets where in time we're able to still maintain our export production at the same level. So we're going to find that agricultural sectors are hit hardest, industrial sectors are hit hardest, where we have manufacturing and we're competing with our global counterparts. These price fluctuations coming from your tariff-related price increases will make us less competitive with foreign goods.
And tragically, behind the hidden curtain is the informal or the casualization of work. And if this perpetuates, it's going to get a lot worse, is it not, under prolonged tariff pressure?
Absolutely. So the job losses and the current instability in the labor market will worsen. So what you're finding now is that you have to ask yourself the real question is, who is exporting, who is South Africa exporting to, and what are the sectors that will be hardest hit? As I've mentioned, those sectors, the value chains of those sectors, the inputs of those sectors will be hardest hit because there'll be lower demand. So on the demand side, all the inputs being labor, the inputs being if you're a supplier of a good or a service within those sectors, you will be affected because the demand will shrink. You will see that the inputs that go into whether the demand for energy services and any other input in the production process, you'll find that energy, whether it's transport services, moving these goods and services, we have massive warehousing and storage facilities that keeps goods on stock when you are exporting. These will be hit harder. So it's the entire value chain. I think on the informal side, the instability, what it means is that the volatility that is more accustomed to traders, you're going to find that that volatility is not eased, it in fact worsened. We're going to find that this has a disproportionate impact on women, because if you do analysis and we've looked at the South African economy, you find that the impact on women is worsened because they're more represented in the informal sectors and the informal labor work in the more precarious sectors. So when businesses don't do well, when households don't do well, immediately, for instance, private households, they'll just do the work themselves. And that means domestic workers don't get employed. That means that your workers outside don't get employed. 1 million in South Africa, we know from the labor force survey, are large in the main, 95% of black African women who are working in private households without necessarily protection from these shifts in the market.
So am I stretching a point here when I say that the role of unions and collective bargaining has possibly been shunted to the margin, and when it comes to the role that they have to play in defending against the erosion of job security?
So this is a very, very difficult question. So there is an issue of the economic strategy and the general neoliberal framework, which has done what we call a freeing up of the markets from what we call rigidity. So immediately when business talks about labor, a lot of the time when you look at the policies we have employed in South Africa, is they talk about labor market deregulation, right? They talk about let's lower input costs. They talk about less rigid markets. What that means is effectively, if you employ policies that want to remove labor protection, basic conditions of employment, minimum wage, all of those type of instruments that try to protect employers, that try to improve the quality of work, and that try to remove the disproportionate effect of unfair labor practices from the working class, you find that the general consensus and the general terminology that's used is let's make it more business friendly. But what it means actually is that you are making the labor market more flexible. You are removing protection from workers. You are ensuring that the bargaining power of unions, even in bargaining councils, is weakened. And you really try to have a narrative that says, you know, these unions are a hindrance. Unions shouldn't be there. And so what it means effectively, the quality of work is appreciating, the protection and the means to protection for employees, and in particular, those who need the social protection, that those who need it are at the brunt of capital. And this is what we're seeing globally. And so I think the effect is that people have less protection. Prohibition becomes, or dismissal becomes, the norm. You're seeing that unfair labor practice, the protection against those, the mechanisms become weaker. So it's not a function of unions per se, but it's a function, I would say, of trade and also industrial and economic policy that doesn't support, right, quality work for employers and employees, or employees rather. It's always at the expense of workers. But the question you have to ask, Jeremy, is why are we not able to make sure that the surpluses, the profits, are dispersed more equitably? What kind of a society do we want where the profits are concentrated amongst a class, and yet you can actually share those proceeds and those profits? And so we're squeezing inputs, which is mainly the working class or the workers, at the expense of society in general, because what it has is there's an unintended consequence on consumption, has an unintended consequence on social cohesion, has an unintended consequence on widening inequality, things like Gini, things like the Gini index and the Gini coefficient, as you know, in South Africa, the worst in the world. Yeah. And so all these unintended consequences, solely because we want to accrue profit, maximize it to an elite or a certain class of people at the expense of society as a whole, is something we really need to reconsider.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Dr. Ntabiseng Moleko, development economist at the University of Stellenbosch's Business School.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, fewer than 14% of South Africans, would you believe, have access to uncapped internet, leaving millions locked out of education, jobs, and economic opportunity. The organization Too Much Wi-Fi believes internet is no longer a luxury, but it's a basic human right. And in that respect, I want to talk to the chief executive officer, Torek Brown. Too Much Wi-Fi, by the way, was started in 2016. It says it has the aim of providing more affordable internet connectivity to aspirational communities. So, Torek, a very warm welcome. Why do you call access then to the internet a basic human right rather than a privilege? What has changed?
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. Frankly, we cannot talk about nation building if we do not address this gap between the have and have nots. And we know majority of our people, as you mentioned, 85% does not have access to what I call meaningful connectivity, connectivity that will allow for generational shifts and change in our people's heritage. And so in today's economy, internet is as essential as water and electricity. And simply put, without it, people cannot participate. Mm. And so they cut off from education and even applying for jobs, let alone upskilling and so forth. So that's why it is essentially a basic human right.
So it's a basic human right. Why is connectivity so low in this country then?
I think for a lot of reasons, right? I think, first of all, the modern internet in our country only really started about just under 10 years ago. And that's something that most people don't really always comprehend. And number two, it's a engineering challenge, and the physics of it make it quite arduous. So there is physical infrastructure that has to be laid. And so our country started, obviously, with the leafy green suburbs and the metros and so forth. But we know that most of our people stay in the peri-urban, rural, and deep rural areas. And so what started as a mission statement really 10 years ago has now become a movement. And today, yeah, we cover a few million people, but there's still a lot of work to do.
Well, there's a lot of work still to be done. Do you think that there is the right policy-enabling environment to accelerate the development and growth of that important infrastructure that you refer to?
That's a tricky one. I'd say yes and no. I have the pleasure of working with our industry body, sitting on that board, and what I've seen there is that like with the general economy, community networks are often the ones that do the biggest part of, or cover the biggest part of the industry. There's two main, I guess, challenges we have there, which is the CapEx. So often the cost to deploy the infrastructure required, number one. And then number two is there has been some policy, let's say, leeway given. So the lower 6 gigahertz band recently was freed up for network operators. But really, if we could push that further, then, you know, it will allow us to reach more people quicker, cheaper, and obviously bring people onto the internet sooner.
Do you think, as far as private players are concerned in the space, they just see it as too risky an investment with too little return?
Absolutely. I don't think there's also the incentive, right? So the incumbents or the players that be, they would focus where their commercial interests are pushed. In our case, we are a socially conscious for-profit business. And so we, whilst we are profit-orientated, we have a commitment of giving 30% of our revenue back to the community that we serve. And that's board mandated. It's not a marketing line item. We realized early on that when people's hungry, you know, when people don't have jobs and so forth, then the providing connectivity is completely useless. And so we've extended our mandate in the beginning to make sure we cover both sides of the issue.
And Tariq, I salute what you're doing, but I would also suggest to you that it's only when the bigger players, the more established players, actually get involved that you're going to break this inertia. And unless they can see commercial advantage to this, nothing really is going to change, in spite of efforts like your company is putting into the process.
I would naturally challenge that, right? I think if we look at, if I have to draw on a well-known example in the South African context, the likes of Capitec taking on the incumbents and so forth, we have a very similar approach for the last 10 years. We've just focused on very narrowly on, first of all, providing connectivity to most of the places that no one goes to. Often we see that we're the only provider. And so at this point, we operate largely in the Western Cape. In the Western Cape, we are bigger than the biggest MNO. So the big names, the red and yellow that you know of. And so we've proven that we, although it's not a well-known fact, that we can take on the biggest.
So going forward then, how long do you think it's going to take before we achieve some kind of industry parity here? Or is this a long road to hostel?
I'm not sure we seek that, Jeremy, to be very honest. We care and are focused and spend our time and resources in the community as opposed to, let's say, more above the line PR points. But there is something to be said there. You do have a point. And so in the more recent months, I've obviously now preaching this message. And so I think there's some good movement. There's some of the big players that looking at the space and trying to get involved and so forth. But as we mentioned at the top of the interview, that there's still a lot of work to be done.
Just a final question. On the flip side of this conversation, when you're engaging in the communities itself, are you finding there is a real hunger, there's a demand, there is a real need for uncapped internet?
You know, Jeremy, I grew up on the Cape Flats, in between Manberg, Steenberg, Otjie, Zikoflay. And so I know firsthand what the internet has done for me. It's allowed me to live and work in 26 different countries. Coming back home now and still seeing my first cousins homeless. I still have cousins that are in gangs and in prisons. I can see the impact firsthand. And so when Auntie Soraya from Bonteville hugs me and thanks me for us, for the people of this company, and the communities, for opening a food garden that now feeds young kids in school programs. When Uncle Farouk from Bahala Park says with tears in his eyes the impact that the internet has had because it keeps young people off the streets a little bit longer than otherwise, then you can see and feel the impact. And so, yes, there's definitely an impact.
Yeah, therein lies the benefit. The Chief Executive Officer of Too Much Wi-Fi, Tariq Brown, thank you very much indeed.
And that is where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.